Well, I'm Caroline Larrington, and along with Stuart, we've been responsible for conceptualizing this event, though it has to be said most of the hard work has been done by other people, including our assistants over here and Kate Forbes, who you will have met on the front desk. So we're absolutely delighted to see you all here. We wondered what kind of dropout rates we might find, but it looks as if everybody who signed up to come has actually turned up, which is a great delight and perhaps even unprecedented. So welcome to the first Bloomsbury Publishing Oxford Summer School on Fantasy. And we very much hope this is going to be an opportunity to explore, to discuss, to anticipate and to imagine fantasy of very many kinds. A few details to start off with. We have to thank Bloomsbury, of course, and we'll be thanking them lavishly during the course of the next couple of days. We have to thank the English faculty, who have afforded a great deal of help in organising, and Exeter College itself, which is, of course, our host in this wonderful building. There isn't a published programme for you all to have a copy of to save paper. Will no one think of the trees, so we decided. But there are QR codes on the wall, and there are programmes pasted up in different places, so you can remind yourself of what's going on. And now a bit of housekeeping. So all of the talks will be in here. The catering is outside. You've probably already spotted the coffee being set up for after the first session. We have two fire exits, one through that door which you came in, and one through this door, which seems to have various constraints about being able to use it to do anything other than run for your lives. The toilets are just outside and to the right. There's toilets of various kinds, and I can already sense from looking at the demographic of this room that there will be plenty of time for the gentlemen to make use of their facilities, and the ladies will be queuing down the hall. But there is another gender-neutral set of toilets just beyond where the catering is, and that's if you go past the catering and as if you're going back to the front door, that's also a possibility. All the talks are going to be recorded, and most of them are being live streamed. So this means that if you ask a question for the people in the hall, the question will all be recorded as well. But you can see from the setup of the camera that nobody is going to film the audience. The cameras are trained on the speakers. And for the people who are with us online, a very special welcome to you in your different time zones. We hope that you'll be able to get as much as possible out of the experience. Not quite the same as being in the room with us here in Oxford, but you too have the opportunity to put questions, and you can put them in the chat, and our chat monitors will find some questions to bring up at the end. So we have a mixture of formats here. We have some longer lectures with time for questions, hopefully time to get a little bit of discussion going. And then we have some shorter 10-minute presentations just to introduce some topics that you might not have thought about. And there's going to be less time for questions, but hopefully we'll get a couple in. And for people who are in person here, of course, there's the opportunity to grab speakers at the meal breaks and ask them further questions. The organisation of our 3 days is quite simple. It's past, present, and future. And so today we're mostly looking at the history of fantasy up into the 20th century. Tomorrow we'll be looking at fantasy in the present, and we've got a very special afternoon planned with our friends from Bloomsbury, who are going to be talking about the state of fantasy and publishing today, and of course presenting some of their authors to talk to you about their own experiences with the genre. On Thursday, our final day, we're looking at the future of fantasy, and that means that we're going to have a different set of perhaps more speculative lectures talking about where fantasy might be going. Why Oxford and why fantasy? And it's important, I think, to note before I wrap up here that Oxford has a claim to be the home of fantasy. It's woven into the history of Oxford, and I'm going to be talking a bit more about this tomorrow. It's the place, perhaps, where modern fantasy began, arguably 150 years ago with Alice in Wonderland. And it's a place where research, study, writing, and thinking about fantasy continues in the university. But as we'll also see, the streets of Oxford are thronged with people who are using Oxford as part of the stimulus for their own imaginations. And we'll see a little bit how far Oxford has fed into the imagining of various fantasy writers, even some who've never been to Oxford, who didn't study here or teach here. Somehow Oxford has got into the genre at a very fundamental level. So at this point, I think it probably remains for me to welcome you all once again, to remind you that we're all here to enjoy ourselves, to learn about fantasy, to think about fantasy and discuss our own ideas. And that means being respectful of other people's views as well. So I hope this is going to be a very friendly, very collegial atmosphere here, and nobody is going to get into enormous fights about whether something is fantasy or not, and fierce kinds of definition. This is not the atmosphere that we're looking for. And so with that, I will bid you all welcome once again. If there are any questions, there will be a roving mic. I don't imagine that there are any questions, particularly at this point. But if you do have a question, do raise your hand. In which case, going slightly early, which is always a good thing when it comes to timekeeping, I'd like to welcome our first speaker, who is Professor Adam Roberts, who doesn't have any slides, so we don't have to put those up, and who has a roving mic, and we will open the floor to him. He's going to be talking to us about an introduction to fantasy literature, long history and theory.
As soon as you're water. Hello, it's lovely to see you all here. What I propose to do is, in essence, is to run through this book, which I wrote. Quite proud of the fact that I wrote this book. It takes a lot of time to write a book, which I urge and exhort you all to buy 7 copies, in case you lose 6. Imagine if you bought 6 copies and then lost all 6. That extra 7th copy could make all the difference. You don't have to buy a copy of this book. Really, you don't. It is published by Bloomsbury, though, so that's one of the reasons why I wanted to flourish it. I wrote a history of science fiction some years ago, and it was suggested to me that I write a history of fantasy as a kind of companion volume. And when I was asked, I thought, yes, I've been a reader of fantasy all my life. I grew up reading Tolkien and Ursula Le Guin. I will do that. Then I started actually writing it and researching it, and I realised that there is a lot of fantasy I haven't read that I had to read in order to write this book, particularly through the 80s and 90s into the 21st century, thousands upon thousands of volumes of fantasy, many of them very, very large, a lot of them parts of enormous, you know, Roman Fleuve series that go on for 15 volumes, and I had to at least try to read a representative sample of all that fantasy. It was quite a lot. What I'm going to do is summarise the argument I make in this book, which is, in essence, a kind of historical account of how we come to that place where fantasy is now such a huge phenomenon. And I'm going to give you a potted version of that. But I'm doing that because there are questions. I think my history of fantasy is right. I would say that, or you'd expect me to say that. But there are questions which I couldn't really answer as I kind of wrote it out. And they still kind of puzzle me. So I'm going to ask you those questions and see if you can answer them for me. And then that'll put my mind at rest and I'll be very grateful. So it's a kind of historicist account of fantasy. And to that end, We can start in the 1960s, and then we can roam backwards, and then, as Gavin was saying, tomorrow and the day after, we can roam forwards into the future of fantasy. But I start in the 60s because it's in the 60s that fantasy kind of explodes. And that's for two reasons. One is Tolkien, and there's no getting around Tolkien, talking about Oxford people sitting in the pubs in Oxford with the Inklings, talking about working through, writing up his great legendarium, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion. The interesting thing about that, I think, is The Lord of the Rings is published 1954, 1955 in three volumes, but it doesn't become a big hit until the 60s, when it's released in paperback form in America, and then it becomes a campus novel and a cult book, and then it becomes a bestseller, and then a global bestseller. And it's never lost that position. It still sells enough to make the bestseller lists kind of annually all the way through. Maybe it flagged a little in the 90s, but then the Peter Jackson movies in the 2000s brought it back into popular consciousness. It's an enormous kind of phenomenon. So that's at the heart of the question that I'm trying to answer myself, which I'm canvassing your opinions of. There's a kind of belatedness there. Why is it in the 60s that fantasy really takes off? In the 60s, it's because partly Tolkien is so influential. And then through the 70s, you have Terry Brooks and Stephen Donaldson and many other writers who are effectively imitating Tolkien, producing fantasies in a Tolkienian style. And then as we move into the 21st century, you get a kind of reaction against that with what they call grimdark, George R.R. Martin and Joe Abercrombie and so on, that aim for, I'm going to put scare quotes around the word, realistic, kind of violent, nasty, fantastical realms. But they're still writing kind of in reaction to Tolkien. And Michael Moorcock dismisses Tolkien as epic Winnie the Pooh and writes his own kind of quite stylish, but still quite cruel, quite violent fantasy novels. He's doing that in reaction to Tolkien. The grimdark seems to me a kind of photographic negative of what Tolkien is doing, which is still marked by the influence of Tolkien. And now romanticism is a big deal now. I read a lot of romanticism. That's also often quite violent, I was surprised actually to discover. It's quite BDSM, it's quite kind of Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey, but in a fantasy realm. So it's the 60s, it's two things. One is Tolkien's just the success of Tolkien, and then people read it and they want to read more stuff like that, and people write extra new fantasy series to meet that demand. But the other thing is the Ballantine adult fantasy list. So Ballantine, the American publisher, saw they issued the first proper paperback edition. There'd been an unauthorized edition issued of Lord of the Rings before. Ballantine did it properly and paid royalties to Tolkien and sold, shed loads of copies of his books. And they, in 1965, put out the Ballantine adult fantasy list, which is, to begin with, was a series of reprints. So the initial list, which came out in 65, was 19 titles. 8 of those titles were Tolkien, so The Hobbit, the 3 Lord of the Rings books, the Donald Swan music that he wrote for the songs of Lord of the Rings, I think Tree and Leaf. Most of them were Tolkien, but they also published The Worm Ouroboros, Edison's great fantasy from the 1920s. They published Gormenghast and Titus Groan, Mervyn Peake's 1940s kind of gothic fantasy. And then Lynn Carter, the American writer and editor, came in and took over the adult fantasy list and published another 65 titles, most of which again were reprints of earlier books. And with those reprints in these new paperback editions, the books became big sellers, which they hadn't been before. So I'm roaming back from the 60s. So the Ballantine's list is the late 60s into the 70s. And that and Tolkien's kind of belated success really marks the arrival of fantasy as a mode. So some of the books we're talking about that came out and were big hits because they were reissued in the Ballantine's list. I mentioned The Worm Ouroboros, Edison's fantasy, strange but rather wonderful book. Dunsany's The King of Elfland's Daughter, which came out in 1924. Hope Mirrolet's Lud in the Mist, which was 1926. So these are books that were published, you know, half a century before and are finding a new audience and, you know, it's kind of disseminating. One of the things I talk about in my history is the way fantasy, which starts as a written form of art, jumps into all different media in the 21st century. And that starts in the 1970s. So the King of Elfland's Daughter, which is a great fantasy novel, was made into a kind of prog rock album with Christopher Lee, of all people, singing in his deep voice, and various other people in the 70s. And television and film and video games, and this is all now colonized, as it were, by fantasy. Fantasy is a mode, is everywhere. That's where it starts from. But what's interesting to me is these are books that were written in the 1920s. So if we wanted to come up with a kind of core canon of fantasy novels through the 20th century, what I think you find is they are marked in a particular way by World War I. So we can talk about Tolkien. Tolkien, of course, served in World War I and rather mournfully reported that all but one of his friends was killed in the war, and he survived the war, came back injured. He started working on his legendarium in the 19-teens as the war was going on, and he starts writing it up seriously in the 1920s. Now, we've got all this posthumously published Tolkieniana, The History of Middle-earth, which, if you're a Tolkien nut, is absolutely wonderful. You can really kind of immerse yourself in that. But one thing, just the sheer size of it, the cliff face of books that have been issued, show how meticulously, kind of thoroughly, Tolkien worked and reworked over and over this material to get it into the state that he wanted it to be. But he was writing as someone who had fought in World War I, and he was writing, I think, in reaction to World War I, that the horrors of, you know, industrialized mass slaughter, that this was modern warfare. He writes instead of an earlier, nobler, more chivalric time where war is romantic and heroic. And you're fighting evil, and a very real evil. John Garth, in his book on Tolkien and the Great War, which is a very good book and I recommend it, explores the ways that Tolkien's specific experiences fed into the descriptions of Mordor that Sam and Frodo have to fight their way through, the horrors of what Sauron is capable of. But that's what is to be defeated. The essence, I think, of what Tolkien is doing, and that what appealed to and continues to appeal to people, is a re-enchantment of the world. And in a nutshell, that's my thesis. So disenchantment, which is a phrase that Max Weber, the sociologist, uses to describe the conditions of modernity. This is where we live, he says. We live in a disenchanted world. It used to be an enchanted world, full of magic and wonder, but also of terror and supernatural kind of peril. But now we're secularized, and we think science describes the world accurately, and there's no room left for any of that magic. We have become disenchanted in several senses of that word. For my history, I lean quite heavily on Charles Taylor, who is a Canadian philosopher. He's still alive, he's quite old, who wrote a book called The Secular Age, which is a very large investigation into the conditions of effectively disenchantment. How do we go from being a religious culture, society, to being a secular one? I mean, people are still religious. Religion hasn't gone away, Taylor says, but we don't really live in a religious world in the way that people did in the Middle Ages, let's say. We live in a secularized, scientific world. The way that Taylor describes that is we have moved from, and these are his terms, from a porous sensibility to a buffered sensibility. It used to be that our sensibilities were porous and things kind of got inside us, and we lived in a world of magic and marvel, but also terror and alarm. You believed there were genuinely nasty things lurking in the woods that might steal your babies. You might be damned and go to hell. You could be frighted by demons and hobgoblins and ghosts. We have, Taylor says, buffered our sensibilities. And as to how that's happened and why that's happened, he's nearly 1,000 pages long, A Secular Age. It's very worthwhile reading. It's fascinating to see whether you agree with his account of how that's happened. But I think it's hard to deny that that has happened. So now we don't have these poorer sensibilities. We're not affrighted in the way that, but we're also not capable of the kind of wonder and the marvel and the magic. C.S. Lewis is very good on this, actually, in his non-fiction works, his accounts of medieval literature. So we have, I suppose, gained something because we're not scared of the creatures that might lurk under the bed. But we have lost something as well. We've lost that sense of kind of marvel, of wonder. So the argument I make in the book, and I steal this argument from the American scholar, Alan Jacobs, but I figure he's in America, and that's a long way away, so he's not going to, you know, be able to get at me. He's a friend of mine, and he's a very mild-mannered guy, but I do credit him. He says that's what fantasy provides. It provides a kind of unbuffering of our sensibilities. It provides us with access, a way of re-enchanting the world. It gives us a fictional world that is enchanted. And that transcendence, that marvel, that wonder, is at the heart of the appeal of fantasy. And that chimed with my experience. I don't know how it is for you when you read fantasy. When I was reading fantasy as a kid, which I did obsessively over and over, my problem with writing the book was that I grew up into a man, and then I put away childish things, and fantasy just kept producing more and more books. So when I had to read them all in a great hurry to write this book, it was a bit of a cram. But when I was a kid, I would read Tolkien over and over again. I read Tolkien, Lord of the Rings every year. And that was, I think, that was a heart of the appeal of it for me, was I was just living a dull, deracinated suburban life. And Middle Earth just seemed so wonderful. I remember feeling as a kid a desire to go there. I mean, that's one of the things I find hard to quite fathom about Grimdark, actually. Who would want to go to Westeros? I mean, it's a horrible place. It's nasty, brutish, and short life there. And yet people do. It's been enormously successful, Song of Fire and Ice and the TV Game of Thrones. There's something going on there. That desire, I mean, in a pure sense, to escape into this more wonderful, more marvellous, more magical world is at the heart of what I think Tolkien was providing. And you can see, having the experiences that he had in the First World War, that he then writes what is a war novel. It's about the War of the Ring, but it's not a war in the way that the Somme was a war. So there's a clutch of fantasy written in the 1920s, in the aftermath of World War I, and that, I think, is kind of written in reaction, I think, to World War I and to modernity and the disenchantments of modernity. And that, I think, is baked into the DNA of fantasy. All the fantasy that gets written carries that through in a kind of historical sense. And that, I think, is, so C.S. Lewis, he was also, he fought in World War I. And when he writes Narnia, he starts writing them in the late 40s and publishes them in the 1950s. The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is also a kind of war novel, with a big battle, and the last in the series is called The Last Battle. And he's, you could say, cathecting his experiences as a soldier. He's also writing as a Christian, as was Tolkien, of course, working that sense of, Tolkien's word for it was sub-creation, where he takes this idea from Coleridge. God is the creator. God made the world. What an artist does is sort of in imitation of that divine act of creativity, in a sort of ratio inferior. It's still creative, but it's a sub-creation, kind of creating his particular kind of world, and it's shot through with his religious sensibilities, as is the case for Narnia. Dunsinane, the King of Elfland's daughter, he served in not only the World War I, he was also in the Boer War, because he was a bit older than Tolkien and Lewis. Edison was a civil servant during the war, so he didn't see kind of action on the front lines, but he was again very marked by the war. And there's a larger sort of literary historical, I mean, this is to be very sketchy about it, because I don't want to take up too much time. There's a larger kind of literary historical account that places modernism and the modernist experiments of writers like Joyce, T.S. Eliot, Virginia Woolf, in the aftermath of World War I, the fascination with experimenting, kind of fracturing narrative and breaking up kind of poetic modes is itself seen. There's quite a lot of criticism on this as a reaction to what the war was doing. Now, my argument, I suppose, is that fantasy is also marked in that way. So this leads me back to the question which I can't quite answer. Dearly as I love fantasy, I read fantasy, I was born in 1965, so I was reading fantasy through the 1970s, 1980s, reading often the same fantasy over and over again. That was just an accident of my chronology. I'm interested in the larger question. Why is there this gap between what happened in World War I and then the writing that emerged out of that, is the argument I'm making, that we call fantasy, that seeds the big kind of contemporary popular phenomenon of fantasy? Why does it only take off in the late 60s? That gap seems interesting to me. What was it about the 60s and the 70s that meant this is the time when fantasy kind of explodes? So it's there throughout the 20th century. And in fact, in the history, I have a section exploring the roots of modern fantasy. And in part, that's quite well-trodden ground. Critics have talked about this, so that both Tolkien and Lewis talk about MacDonald's Fantasies, which P-H-A-N-T-E, it'd be good to have a slide deck, actually, then you could see what all these books were. I don't know, though, I just get so many lecturers who just stand at a lectern and read out a prepared script. You're thinking, well, just give me the paper and I'll read it in half the time. And so George MacDonald's Fantasies, which is 1858, so right in the middle of the Victorian period, which is a story about a character called Nodos, rather unusual name, who is in his study in a regular Victorian house, and it turns into a fantasy kingdom, and he's able to move from our world into this marvelous, magical fantasy realm. Farah Mendelssohn's book, Rhetorics of Fantasy, I don't know if anyone has come across that. This is a kind of whistle-stop tour of some of the kind of key critical works on fantasy. Mendelssohn's book identifies four, it's a kind of a structuralist account of fantasy in a way. She identifies four types of fantasy. But I think what's really clever about her book is that it turns out that all four are kind of the same. So she says there are what she calls immersive fantasies, like The Lord of the Rings, which take place in their own world. And we can't go from our world to their world, it's just its own self-contained place. And there are what she calls portal fantasies, where you start in our world, as the children do in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and you go through a portal, a wardrobe in that book, into the fantasy realm. It's very cleverly pitched by Lewis, I think, that whole scene. In fact, I think one of the things I'm not so happy about in the later books in the Narnia series is that Lewis feels he has to go back and kind of explain all the features of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Why a wardrobe? Why is the first thing they see a lamp post? And I think that he does explain it all, and I think that kind of robs it of some of its amazing kind of marvel and mystery. And actually it's a sort of dreamlike process, isn't it? They go through the wardrobe, and inside the wardrobe are fur coats, because it's winter on the other side, and it's always winter and never Christmas, of course. So they put on the fur coats, and then they come out into a forest of fir trees, like a sort of conceptual pun, which is what happens when one dreams. It feels, it kind of rings true. So portal fantasies, immersive fantasies, portal fantasies, and then the other two kinds of fantasies are actually just another way of saying portal fantasy. So one is intrusion fantasy, where there is a portal, but instead of us going into the fantasy realm, creatures from the fantasy realm come into our world. And then the final section, which is the shortest section in Mendelssohn's book, is she calls liminal fantasies that take place in the kind of ambiguous borderline between our world and the fantasy world. But what she points out, and I think this is important, is that even in immersive fantasies, there is a kind of portal, almost always. So if we think of Lord of the Rings or, you know, The Hobbit, we think of Middle Earth, it's its own realm, and you immerse yourself as a reader in this imagined world. Nonetheless, the story takes us from a kind of recognisable, cosy, suburban, slightly modern world of the hobbits. And they have to leave the Shire and they have to move out into the perilous realm, into the wider world where all the excitement and adventures and magic and marvels happen. And it's not literally a portal, it's not a wardrobe they have to go through, but there is still that trajectory. So my kind of prehistory of fantasy, if we go back, I think it probably, it's one thing I say right at the beginning is, I could have written a book about almost everything, because we could argue that fantasy is a sort of default logic of storytelling for human beings. We could argue the Epic of Gilgamesh is kind of a fantasy. We could argue that Homer and Beowulf and medieval romances are all kind of fantasies. I don't think that's true, because I think modern fantasy is as we read it now, as it's constructed now, is written out of that logic of disenchanted modernity. And actually it's quite a modern form fantasy. It feels older because it's often set in the medievalized world or an ancient world, but actually it's quite a contemporary. It's newer, I think, than science fiction. In my science fiction history, I say science fiction starts in about 1600. It goes back a long way. Fantasy, I think, really doesn't get going until the later 19th century. And there are three kind of roots that feed through then into 20th century fantasy. And one is, we mentioned Alice in Wonderland, one is children's fantasy in the 19th century. So Lewis Carroll and the Water Babies and lots of other, you know, stories like that, which are set in their own fantastical realms. Another is the revival of Arthurian literature. So Arthurian literature, which was very popular in the Middle Ages, just falls out of fashion. No one really writes anything Arthurian for hundreds of years. It's quite an odd kind of observation about literary history. John Milton thought, I'll write a great epic of England and it will be about King Arthur. And then John Milton thought, no, I won't do King Arthur. I'll do God and Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. And so he writes Paradise Lost. And there aren't really any Arthurian fantasies or epics until the 19th century. And then for some reason in the 19th century, there's a huge glut of them. Suddenly everyone's writing Arthurian literature again. And that's continued through. That's continued to be popular through the 20th and into the 21st century. The myths and legends associated with King Arthur, which you can trace into lots of, you know, classic fantasy novels as well. And that's Tennyson's Idylls of the King and William Morris writing poetry, particularly in an Arthurian mode, and William Morris's prose fantasies at the end of the 19th century, which Tolkien was very full of praise for and influenced by. But it's also Wagner's Ring Cycle and his Tristram and Isolde, which of course is an Arthurian story. Why Arthurian literature kind of came rushing back in the 19th century is an interesting question, which I could go on at greater length. The third strand, I think, is John Bunyan and The Pilgrim's Progress, and that, again, is an argument I make. So Bunyan published his book much earlier, but it's in the 19th century that that book becomes an absolutely global phenomenon, and it's partly because it was widely reprinted, it was taken by missionaries and evangelicals all around the world, because it's a religious allegory, and it's there to make us more godly, and so on. But it's also a fantasy, a compellingly written fantasy quest through this really vividly imagined. I mean, it is an allegory and everything in it stands for something else, but the world comes alive as you read it. And it was so popular in the 19th century, it's hard to overstate how popular The Pilgrim's Progress was. And I think these things then feed into the way fantasy gets written. Not that Tolkien or Lewis were writing allegories. I don't think they were. So Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings, in the preface, says, it's not an allegory, Lord of the Rings. I cordially dislike allegory, he says, and have done so ever since I grew old and wary enough to detect its presence. People think the Narnia books are allegory. They think The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is an allegorical tale about the passion of Christ and the death and resurrection of Christ. I don't think it is. I don't think Lewis thought it was. There's a difference there, which I don't want to get too kind of super fine about, but I think it's sort of important. The Narnia books are Lewis indulging his lifelong fascination with the idea of talking animals. He was called Jack by all his friends, even though his name was Clive Staples Lewis. You know why he was called Jack? Because his pet dog he had as a boy was called Jack, and he identified really, really strongly with this dog, and he wished the dog could talk, and he was fascinated by the idea of telling stories in a land where the animals can talk. Okay, so he writes Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and it's set in a fantasy land where the animals can all talk. Not all of them, some of them can't, but most of them can. What then happens is, he thinks, as a Christian, in our world, Christ incarnated as a man, because ours is a human world. And that's important. If you're a Christian, that's a really important point of belief. Christ was God incarnated in bodily form. He wasn't like a symbolic representation of God. He didn't represent God. He wasn't an allegorical version of God. He was God. This is incarnation. So Lewis says, well, what would it look like in a world of talking animals? How would Christ incarnate in such a world? Well, he would incarnate as a talking animal. And we have Aslan, the lion. It is that story. It's a Christian story, but it's not an allegorical retelling of that Christian story. And that logic of incarnation is central, I think, to both what Lewis and Tolkien are doing. Tolkien's emphasis, I think, is a little different. There are lots of kind of Christian parallels in the way he writes his narrative. And I think that does owe something to what Bunyan is doing in The Pilgrim's Progress. But again, it's about bodying that into an imagined world. So I trace these kind of 19th century roots, but I think it is, the catalyst is then the First World War. And then what happens after the First World War is people write in reaction to that. I'm just wondering how much longer I have to, I don't want to go rambling on. I mean, I'm going to come back to my question. If anyone has an answer to this question, please shout it out, and I will reward you with gold and silver. But my question, so why do we think there was... I mean, I think I'm right in saying this, okay? I mean, you could disagree. You could say, no, I've misunderstood the history of fantasy across the 20th century, but I don't think so. I think fantasy is a kind of small-scale thing for most of the century, and that it explodes in the late 60s and in the 70s. And then it just keeps exploding. There's a delta of a vast number of fantasy novels are published through the 80s and 90s, and that's just continuing. It's changing mode. It's now as popular in, I mean, video games are full of kind of the tropes of fantasy. Some of them are actually literally based on Tolkien. Many are just based in a kind of Tolkienian fantastical universe. The movies have been very successful, and TV series. In comic books and games, I talk quite a lot about Dungeons and Dragons and how that has kind of part of the kind of the flow, the river of fantasy through the into the modern day. Fantasy's become much more global, so there's a much greater diversity and variety of fantastical realms. It's not all now based on kind of an idea of the Anglo-Saxon and medieval bits of Northwest Europe, which is what Tolkien was interested in. For a long time, that was the default of fantasy, but now you get fantasy realms and kingdoms that are based on African and Indian and East Asian and South American traditions and cultures and heritages, and it's become a much more diverse, which I think is a very good thing. But it continues in popularity in a way that it wasn't before. So, let me summarise, and then we'll see if you can answer my question for me. And I will indeed be grateful, although possibly I may have overstated when I said I would reward you with gold, because the only gold I've got is my wedding ring, and my wife would kill me if I gave that away. And I shouldn't give away a ring. That would, given the topic of the summer school here today. So I think there is a sense in which what we could call fantastica is kind of the default of human storytelling. We like stories about fantastical things. There is a tradition of writing which you can call realist. I generally fight shy of realism as a term because it means something quite specific, actually. It refers to a particular school of novelists in the late 19th century, mostly in France, people like Zola, Tolstoy, George Eliot, who were aiming to, like, le naturalisme, they were aiming to absolutely reproduce the kind of qualia of lived experience. A sort of documentary verisimilitude was underlying their work. Well, when we say realist, what we really mean is books that don't have fantastical elements in them, books that are set in a kind of recognisable world. such as the one that we live in. That is a strand in literature, that's important, but I think there are many, many more stories, going right back to the beginning of storytelling, that include elements of fantasy, magic and monsters and quests and treasure and so on. But even if we limit it to the roots of modern fantasy, the explosion of fantasy in the 60s and 70s, and where we are now with this kind of global fantasy culture, why is there this lag? Why is it that fantasies that are germinated, sometimes literally in World War I, but out of the experience of that war, written and published in the 20s and 30s, and then through into the 40s and 50s, and the 50s are Tolkien and Lewis, why do they only take off in the late 60s and 70s? What is it about that generation, or that historical moment, that means that's when fantasy becomes a huge deal? Because it's working with a kind of creative belatedness. The Ballantine List was republishing books published all the way back. I mean, they republished some of Morris's romances from the 1890s. And they published, you know, Mud in the Mist, which is 26, and Worm of Ouroboros, which is 24. So this is a long lag. Do we know? Has anyone an idea?
I have a go. I'm going to come at it. Knowledge of history is mainly influenced by Ken Follett.
Okay.
Can we hang on for a second while we bring you a rope?
Okay.
Just before you answer, let's thank Adam very much. Right, we have a roving mic, which you now have. So do answer the question for us.
Go on.
I suppose in the 60s and 70s, there's a few things going on. It's a bit more creative freedom. So an obvious example being the Beatles, more creative expression at that time. And I wonder if there's an element of having that creative freedom, being able to choose a bit more and not being ashamed of your choices, what you can read.
That's an interesting idea. I wonder.
That's my first.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that the Beatles were slated to appear in a film of Lord of the Rings.
Yes. And the Jungle Book.
And the Jungle as well. But no. I'm not to interrupt your questions, but it's certainly true that the initial kind of boom, the great success, popularity of Lord of the Rings was a kind of, it correlated with the counterculture, with students and hippies, and it's Vietnam War, it was kind of anti-war protests, a kind of ruralism, and maybe it is because you're right. And then it feeds almost immediately through into pop music when Led Zeppelin released songs that are all about escaping from Mordor and prog rock. Is there more creative freedom? Do we think there was more creative freedom in the 60s?
I think so.
Yeah, maybe. Except that the creative freedom was... the things like the Lady Chatterley trial, which was 63. So that then said, after that, you can put sex in your novels now. You couldn't really do that before, because it would fall foul of the... it would be obscene and would be prosecuted for it. And now there's a lot more sex in fiction. That's a kind of creative freedom, I suppose, but not really in classic fantasy, not until you get to romanticy. Did you have another point? I interrupted.
My second theory was, I suppose it's a large time of change in terms of the ruling classes, the feeling that if you put your mind in that, it's something you maybe can start to achieve. And if you look at the main protagonists of those sorts of literature, even Frodo, a very ordinary individual aiming to achieve great things, I wonder if there's maybe a bit more of a connection, for example.
Yeah, you think the common man.
Yeah. Classically, romance in the medieval sense is about kings and princes and great knights and warriors. There's quite a lot of that in Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's sometimes hard because I work at the University of London. I teach at Royal Holloway. And it can be hard for students to get their heads around the way class articulates itself in The Lord of the Rings. That Frodo and Sam read to a lot of people today as, well, they're friends going off on a... they're not, though. Frodo's the master and Sam is the servant. And it's modelled, actually, I think, on a kind of military logic. Not explicitly, but I think that's what's behind it. Frodo's like an officer and Sam is like his Batman. Not Batman in that sense, in the traditional, the old-fashioned sense. That's really interesting. So something about, the world... I mean, the world is changing, and it's changing more rapidly, I suppose, across that period. So something about the common man. Do we think? Something about creative freedom? We've got some more questions back here.
Then we'll take an online question after this one, if you have one.
I'm so sorry. I really want gold and silver and a free copy of your book. I'm to have a go at that.
Okay.
From the perspective of a psychologist, historian, and cultural historian, and fiction writer myself. So, but I think there are two factors at play in the 60s and the 70s. The first one is re-traumatization with the Second World War. This is side history hat on. Because that way the audiences can then connect with the First World War generation to kind of really chime in with their concerns and with these narratives. And then, you know, there's lots more to be said on that. But the second one, I think, if we look at it from the point of mimetic theory, this is a time when, through development of technology, fantasy becomes a sort of meme-plex. So it's not just one meme, it's a series of memes which kind of co-evolve. And, I'm sorry. And, I think what happens is that this is a time when you can actually start producing high fidelity memes. Because before that, they are very much kind of approximation. We've got oral culture, we've got from book printing onwards, there's a high chance of producing high buying memes. But I think once fantasy kind of falls into this category of cultural phenomenon and becomes a meme, this is when it takes off.
Okay, that's really interesting. I certainly think there's a hospitality in Tolkien's writing. It invites you into his world, and it's a major part of the kind of reception of fantasy. It's not just people sitting in their bedrooms reading these novels, although that's part of it, obviously. It's also, you know, fan engagements where you can dress up as your favourite character from Lord of the Rings. It is sharing memes. It's having a kind of shared thing in common.
And you can do all this instantly.
Yeah, but some texts are more are better at that than others, aren't they? For some reason, you know, Star Wars, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings are endlessly memed and they're everywhere, whereas lots of other perfectly good texts are not. I mean, I think Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea books are amongst the greatest fantasy novels ever written, but no one memes them. And they've been adapted, they've had various television, film adaptations, they're widely read, they're great novels. Why those books don't, but somehow Tolkien does, and I suppose Narnia does to a certain extent. That's really interesting. I mean, the generational question seems a little blurred to me, because it is the generation that first embraced Tolkien was a generation that grew up after the war. It was their parents who fought in the war. They were the first generation kind of free of war. I mean, the Vietnam War was obviously going on, so they weren't, not the war has gone away, but that kind of complete saturation of a generation by the experience of war. I think you're quite right. I think that speaks back to the First World War. And then,
if you think of it, even our generation, I'm a bit younger, but we grew up in the shadow of the Second World War and the fear of the Third World War, you know, all the kind of nuclear stuff. So for them, you know, reading the ring as the nuclear bomb or whatever. So I think it's very much the response to the re-traumatization of the Second World War. But I'll shut up.
No, that's really interesting.
Can we have a question from the online community? Do we have one for our moderators?
Yeah. And I'll repeat the question for the benefit of the online viewers. Yeah. Okay, so that can be heard. I won't repeat the question.
Assuming this works. There are quite a lot of people offering answers to this question.
Excellent.
And a lot of
I haven't got gone for all of them, though. I can't, but
I have to go and kill a dragon, don't I?
So, one point that's brought up quite repeatedly is the idea that perhaps an increase in leisure time in the 60s due to some home technological advances might have increased need for escapism, with the monotony of everyday life sort of freed up with free time. That's one point. Someone has suggested access to drugs during the 60s might have helped.
drugs.
Where was it? Actually, several people suggested drugs.
I can't imagine what it was about a novel that contains Gandalf smoking his pipe
actually and Tom Bombadil dancing around.
Yes. Would appeal to drug culture. Yes, that's interesting.
Someone has pointed out perhaps it's access to cheaper paperbacks. With the cultural dominance of the U.S. and protracted conflict in Vietnam, a greater need for reenchantment as that conflict continued. The
yeah.
Society might have something to do with it.
I think the fact that it does...
It takes off in America in the first instance at that time, and the Vietnam War is the it's not a kind of, it's not like the Second World War. It's not a kind of just war. It's a war that you can protest, and that kind of shapes a particular identity. I think there is something in, youth culture emerges after World War II. There isn't, because young people for the first time have disposable income. That's why pop music comes about then. The history of pop music is again very interesting. It's kind of intertwined with fantasy in strange ways, but the initial invention of what was in the day, in my day, vinyl records, the companies that produced them assumed they would be used for dictation. So people would dictate and then their secretaries would write up. So that's why the record companies all have names like Parlophone or His Master's Voice that we would record onto records as dictation devices. They had no idea that people would want to buy pre-recorded music and listen to it, but of course they did in huge numbers in the 60s. That's the Beatles coming to fame. And that's because, for the first time, there was a group of generation that had leisure time and disposable income in a way that hadn't been true before. And fantasy, I suppose, has something to do with that. It's the, yeah, these are all good answers, but I'm sorry, I'm not giving out my gold ring, because it's not making me invisible, though.
Small questions over here. So
we try over there.
If you want to pick one of that cluster down there at the back.
Another movement that got started in the 60s was environmentalism, science being published in the early 60s, and I wondered if you see a connection between that and the boom in fantasy. Like, I find early fantasy, especially The Lord of the Rings, so concerned with the moral value of the natural world. And
yeah,
that's a really good point. Again, it's a question as to why it was in the 60s that environmentalism, they used to call it ecology, and now we call it environmentalism and green ideas. Well, that was in the 60s, 65, Dune was published. But that's right, Frank Herbert dedicates Dune to dry land ecologists, which is such a great dedication. I generally dedicate my novels to, my wife or my kids or something. It's an idea, isn't it, that kind of, again, it's not that people have been concerned about the natural world for a long time, but it becomes a kind of real concern. I suppose that's reactive. I suppose that's the sense that industrialization is accelerating and that the world is more polluted than it was, and it's Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. And certainly, it seems to me Lord of the Rings is really quite keenly engaged with a valorization of the natural world. It's one of the ways that you can see the different emphasis in the movie adaptations. It's not just that Peter Jackson cuts out Tom Bombadil, although he does, tragically. It's that those movies, the emphasis is much more on the fighting, on war. And in there is fighting, there are battles in the novel, but the novel is kind of more interested in, like, trees, let's say. That seems more important to Tolkien than war, in a way. And he loves his trees, and walking trees. So that's, yeah, okay. That doesn't connect with the drugs, though. You're not saying people became... That's true.
Okay, maybe herbal things. Take one more question from that corner, and then we may have to wrap up.
Yeah, I just want to come out from the religious angle a little bit. I think at that time, 60s and 70s, we were kind of seeing a wave of secularization in church attendance. I think church attendance was kind of falling off a cliff at that time. So I think for young people, there's, irreligion and kind of distrust of traditional religious structures, but they also want transcendence, a kind of spiritual seekers that see in fantasy a kind of a way to get that kind of transcendence. And I think it's a big multiplying tool in terms of fundamentally religious work. And I think even people who couldn't stand Catholicism might be attracted to that kind of humanist sense as well at the same time.
Yeah, he said that in a letter to a Jesuit priest. And the priest had written, a friend who happened to be a Jesuit priest had written to Tolkien saying, I'm just puzzled as to why are there no churches or temples in Middle Earth? Why does nobody pray or go to worship? And it's true, in the Middle Earth, the world is really detailed in its world building, and the social structures and the landscapes and the languages and everything is carefully kind of mapped out, but there are no temples, there are no churches, no one seems to have a religious life, and that's strange, it's rare. Most fantasies written in imitation of Tolkien include that, because that's part of human life. And Tolkien says, no, I deliberately left all that out, because the work is fundamentally Catholic and religious in conception. If I put the religion into the work as well, that would just kind of confuse matters, that would tangle things up. It's the work itself is kind of religious. But it is, I think it is, yeah, I think there are, in fact, I'd say something kind of more than just that. I think that is right. I think part of the appeal of fantasy is it gives, in a kind of ecumenical sense, that kind of transcendence, that enchantment, that wonder, without needing to be specifically religious. But I also think that one of the through lines that I trace in the book has to do with Wagner, who also wrote a series of great texts, great operas about a magic ring, and it has a dragon in it and a dwarf and all sorts of things going on. It's the Ring of the Nibelung. And Tolkien was always very cross when people said, oh, you were influenced by Wagner, weren't you? He said, no, my ring. Both rings were round, and there the resemblance ends, is what he put it. But it clearly is kind of influential. But I think it's also a very potted history of the reception of Wagner. Is he's still a very towering figure in music. But he was enormous through the late 19th century through the first half of the 20th century. He was a towering kind of artistic figure. And he kind of isn't so much after World War II because he's so German, because his myths are so kind of tied kind of to Germanness in a way that is kind of polluted by the Nazis. The Nazis are very fond of Wagner. Hitler attended performances of The Ring, The Nibelung, and so on, German heroism and the German folk. I make this argument, and I'm a little bit less secure in this, I think, but I still will make the argument that Tolkien provides some of the satisfactions of Wagner without being tied to a specific national ethos or culture. So it's not nationalist. It is kind of about England, isn't it, Lord of the Rings? And he says he's providing a mythology for England and so on, but in a kind of non-denominational way. It means you don't have to have any particular affection for English nationalism to connect with all those elements in Lord of the Rings. But yeah, I'm straying from the point, which is a kind of chronological point, isn't it? Which is, I think you're right, there is an increase in secularization through the 60s and 70s, and it's tied up with that.
Right, I think...
Am I rambling on? I'm sorry.
To wrap it up, do see Adam outside later for your gold and silver or or other fine reward for your answers. If we got a definitive answer here, we could all go home, actually.
Yes, that's it.
Maybe it's the case that we don't have to do it. But let's thank Adam once again.
Thank you.